Similarly, also, one that is a prey to his desires, and that exceeds in everything possible, is profligate. And one that is deficient, and does not desire even to a proper degree and in a natural way, but is as devoid of feeling as a stone, is insensitive. The man that seeks gain from every source is a profiteer, and he that seeks gain, if not from no source, yet from few, is a waster. He that pretends to have more possessions than he really has is a boaster, and he that pretends to have fewer is a self-depreciator. One that joins in approval more than is fitting is a flatterer. One that does so less than is fitting is surly. To be too complacent is subservience. To be complacent seldom and reluctantly is stubbornness. Again, the man that endures no pain, not even if it is good for him, is luxurious. One that can endure all pain alike is, strictly speaking, nameless, but by metaphor he is called hard, patient, or enduring. He that rates himself too high is vain. He that rates himself too low, small-spirited. Again, he that exceeds in all expenditure is prodigal. He that falls short in all, mean. Similarly, the shabby man and the swaggerer, the latter exceeds what is fitting, and the former falls below it. The rascal grasps profit by every means and from every source. The simpleton does not make profit, even from the proper sources. Envy consists in being annoyed at prosperity more often than one ought to be, for the envious are annoyed by the prosperity even of those who deserve to prosper. The opposite character is less definitely named. 1221b. But it is the man that goes too far in not being annoyed even at the prosperity of the undeserving, and is easygoing, as gluttons are in regard to food, whereas his opposite is difficult-tempered in respect of jealousy. It is superfluous to state in the definition that the specified relation to each thing must not be accidental. No science, whether theoretical or productive, makes this addition to the definition either in discourse or in practice. But this addition is aimed against the logical quibbling of the sciences. Let us then accept these simple definitions, and let us make them more precise when we are speaking about the opposite dispositions. But these modes of emotion themselves are divided into species designated according to their difference in respect of time or intensity or in regard to one of the objects that cause the emotions. I mean, for instance, that a man is called quick-tempered from feeling the emotion of anger sooner than he ought, harsh and passionate from feeling it more than he ought, bitter from having a tendency to cherish his anger, violent and abusive owing to the acts of retaliation to which his anger gives rise. Men are called gourmands or gluttons and drunkards from having an irrational liability to indulgence in one or the other sort of nutriment. But it must not be ignored that some of the vices mentioned cannot be classed under the heading of manner, if manner is taken to be feeling the emotion to excess. For example, a man is not an adulterer because he exceeds in intercourse with married women, for excess does not apply here, but adultery merely in itself is a vice, since the term denoting the passion implicitly denotes that the man is vicious, and similarly with outrage. Hence men dispute the charge and admit intercourse but deny adultery on the ground of having acted in ignorance or under compulsion, or admit striking a blow but deny committing an outrage, and similarly in meeting the other charges of the same kind. These points having been taken, we must next say that since the spirit has two parts and the virtues are divided between them, one set being those of the rational part, intellectual virtues whose work is truth, whether about the nature of a thing or about its mode of production, while the other set belongs to the part that is irrational but possesses appetition. For if the spirit is divided into parts, not any and every part possesses appetition. It therefore follows that the moral character is vicious or virtuous by reason of pursuing or avoiding certain pleasures and pains. This is clear from the classification of the emotions, faculties, and states of character. For the faculties and the states are concerned with the modes of emotion, and the emotions are distinguished by pain and pleasure, so that it follows from these considerations, as well as from the positions already laid down, that all moral goodness is concerned with pleasures and pains. For our state of character is related to and concerned with such things as have the property of making every person's spirit worse and better. 1222a. But we say that men are wicked owing to pleasures and pains, through pursuing and avoiding the wrong ones or in the wrong way. Hence all men readily define the virtues as insensitiveness or tranquility in regard to pleasures and pains, and the vices by the opposite qualities. But since it has been assumed that goodness is a state of character of a sort that causes men to be capable of doing the best actions and gives them the best disposition in regard to the greatest good, and the best and greatest good is that which is in accordance with right principle, and this is the mean between excess and deficiency relative to ourselves, it would necessarily follow that moral goodness corresponds with each particular middle state, and is concerned with certain mean points in pleasures and pains, and pleasant and painful things. And this middle state will sometimes be in pleasures, for even in these there is excess and deficiency, sometimes in pains, sometimes in both. For he that exceeds in feeling delight exceeds in the pleasant, and he that exceeds in feeling pain exceeds in the opposite, and this whether his feelings are excessive absolutely or excessive in relation to some standard, for instance, are felt more than ordinary men feel them, whereas the good man feels in the proper way. And since there is a certain state of character which results in its possessors being in one instance such as to accept an excess, and in another such as to accept a deficiency of the same thing, it follows that as these actions are contrary to each other and to the mean, so also the states of character that cause them are contrary to each other and to virtue. It comes about, however, that sometimes all the oppositions are more evident, sometimes those on the side of excess, in some cases those on the side of deficiency. The cause of this contrariety is that the resemblance does not always reach the same point of inequality in regard to the middle, but sometimes it may pass over more quickly from the excess, sometimes from the deficiency, to the middle state, the person farther removed from which seems to be more contrary. For instance, with regard to the body, excess is more healthy and nearer the middle than deficiency, in the case of exercises, but deficiency than excess in the case of food. Consequently, the states of will favourable to athletic training will be variously favourable to health according to the two different fields of choice. In the one case, the over-energetic men will be nearer the mean than the slack ones. In the other, the too hardy will be nearer the mean than the self-indulgent ones. And also the character contrary to the moderate and rational will be in the one case the slack, and not both the slack and the over-energetic, and in the other case the self-indulgent, and not the man who goes hungry. And this comes about because from the start our nature does not diverge from the mean in the same way as regards everything, but in energy we are deficient, and in self-indulgence excessive. And this is also the same with regard to the spirit. And we class as contrary to the mean the disposition to which we and most men are more liable to err, whereas the other passes unnoticed as if non-existent, because its rarity makes it not observed. For instance, we count anger the contrary of gentleness and the passionate man the contrary of the gentle, 1222b. Yet there is also excess in the direction of being gentle and placable, and not being angry when struck. But men of that sort are few, and everyone is more prone to the other extreme, on which account, moreover, a passionate temper is not a characteristic of a toady. And since we have dealt with the scheme of states of character in respect of the various emotions in which there are excesses and deficiencies, and of the opposite states in accordance with which men are disposed in accordance with right principle, though the question, what is the right principle, and what rule is to guide us in defining the mean, must be considered later, it is evident that all the forms of moral goodness and badness have to do with excesses and deficiencies of pleasures and pains, and that pleasures and pains result from the states of character and modes of emotion mentioned. But then the best state in relation to each class of thing is the middle state. It is clear, therefore, that the virtues will be either all or some of these middle states. Let us therefore take another starting point for the ensuing inquiry. Now all essences are by nature first principles of a certain kind, owing to which each is able to generate many things of the same sort as itself. For example, a man engenders men, and in general, an animal animals, and a plant plants. And in addition to this, obviously man alone among animals initiates certain conduct, for we should not ascribe conduct to any of the others. And the first principles of that sort, which are the first source of motions, are called first principles in the strict sense, and most rightly those that have necessary results. Doubtless God is a ruling principle that acts in this way. But the strict sense of first principle is not found in first principles incapable of movement, for example those of mathematics, although the term is indeed used of them by analogy. For in mathematics, if the first principle were changed, virtually all the things proved from it would change, though they do not change owing to themselves, one being destroyed by the other, except by destroying the assumption and thereby establishing a proof. But man is a first principle of a certain motion, for action is motion. And since, as in other matters, the first principle is a cause of the things that exist or come into existence because of it, we must think as we do in the case of demonstrations. For example, if as the angles of a triangle are together equal to two right angles, the angles of a quadrilateral are necessarily equal to four right angles. That the angles of a triangle are equal to two right angles is clearly the cause of that fact, and supposing a triangle were to change, a quadrilateral would necessarily change too. For example, if the angles of a triangle became equal to three right angles, the angles of a quadrilateral would become equal to six right angles, or if four, eight. Also, if a triangle does not change but is as described, a quadrilateral, too, must of necessity be as described. The necessity of what we are arguing is clear from analytics. At present, we cannot either deny or affirm anything definitely except just this. Supposing there were no further cause of the triangles having the property stated, then the triangle would be a sort of first principle or cause of the later stages. Hence, if in fact there are among existing things some that admit of the opposite state, their first principles also must necessarily have the same quality. 1223a. For of things that are of necessity, the result is necessary, albeit the subsequent stages may possibly happen in the opposite way. And the things that depend on men themselves in many cases belong to this class of variables, and men are themselves the first principle of things of this sort. Hence it is clear that all the actions of which a man is the first principal and controller may either happen or not happen, and that it depends on himself for them to happen or not, as he controls their existence or non-existence. But of things which it depends on him to do or not to do, he is himself the cause. And what he is the cause of depends on himself. And since goodness and badness and the actions that spring from them are in some cases praiseworthy, and in other cases blameworthy, for praise and blame are not given to things that we possess from necessity or fortune or nature, but to things of which we ourselves are the cause. Since for things of which another person is the cause, that person has the blame and the praise. It is clear that both goodness and badness have to do with things where a man is himself the cause and origin of his actions. We must, then, ascertain what is the kind of actions of which a man is himself the cause and origin. Now we all agree that each man is the cause of all those acts that are voluntary and purposive for him individually, and that he is not himself the cause of those that are involuntary. And clearly he commits voluntarily all the acts that he commits purposely. It is clear, then, that both goodness and badness will be in the class of things voluntary. We must, therefore, ascertain what voluntary and involuntary mean, and what is purposive choice, since they enter into the definition of goodness and badness. And first we must consider the meaning of voluntary and involuntary. Now they would seem to refer to one of three things: conformity with appetition, or with purposive choice, or with thought. Voluntary is what conforms with one of these, and involuntary is what contravenes one of them. But moreover, there are three subdivisions of appetition: wish, passion, and desire, so that we have to distinguish these. And first, we must consider conformity with desire. It would seem that everything that conforms with desire is voluntary. For everything involuntary seems to be forced, and what is forced, and everything that people do or suffer under necessity, is painful, as indeed Evenus says, "For all necessity doth cause distress." Evenus of Paros, Theog 472. So that if a thing is painful, it is forced, and if a thing is forced, it is painful. But everything contrary to desire is painful, for desire is for what is pleasant, so that it is forced and involuntary. Therefore, what conforms with desire is voluntary, for things contrary to and things in conformity with desire are opposite to one another. Again, all wickedness makes a man more unrighteous, and lack of self-control seems to be wickedness, and the uncontrolled man is the sort of man to act in conformity with desire contrary to calculation, and he shows his lack of control when his conduct is guided by desire. 1223b. So that the uncontrolled man will act unrighteously by acting in conformity with desire. But unrighteous action is voluntary. Therefore, he will be acting voluntarily, and action guided by desire is voluntary. Indeed, it would be strange if those who become uncontrolled will be more righteous. From these considerations, then, it would appear that what is in conformity with desire is voluntary, and from this the opposite follows. For all that a man does voluntarily, he wishes to do, and what he wishes to do, he does voluntarily. But nobody wishes what he thinks to be bad. But yet the uncontrolled man does not do what he wishes, for being uncontrolled means acting against what one thinks to be best, owing to desire. Hence it will come about that the same person is acting voluntarily and involuntarily at the same time. But this is impossible. And further, the self-controlled man will get righteously, or more righteously than lack of control will. For self-control is goodness, and goodness makes men more righteous. And a man exercises self-control when he acts against his desire in conformity with rational calculation. So that if righteous action is voluntary, as also unrighteous action, for both of these seem to be voluntary, and if one of them is voluntary, it follows of necessity that the other is also. Whereas what is contrary to desire is involuntary, it therefore follows that the same person will do the same action voluntarily and involuntarily at the same time. The same argument applies also in the case of passion. For there appear to be control and lack of control of passion as well as of desire, and what is contrary to passion is painful, and restraint is a matter of force. So that if what is forced is involuntary, what is in accordance with passion will always be voluntary. Even Heraclitus seems to have in view the strength of passion when he remarks that the checking of passion is painful, for it is difficult, he says, to do battle with passion, for it buys its wish at the price of life. And if it is impossible to do the same act voluntarily and involuntarily at the same time, and in respect of the same part of the act, action guided by one's wish is more voluntary than action guided by desire or passion. And a proof of this is that we do many things voluntarily without anger or desire. It remains, therefore, to consider whether acting as we wish and acting voluntarily are the same. This also seems impossible. For it is a fundamental assumption with us, and a general opinion, that wickedness makes men more unrighteous, and lack of self-control seems to be a sort of wickedness. But from the hypothesis that acting as we wish and acting voluntarily are the same, the opposite will result. For nobody wishes things that he thinks to be bad, yet he does them when he has become uncontrolled. So if to do injustice is voluntary, and the voluntary is what is in accordance with one's wish, then when a man has become uncontrolled, he will no longer be acting unjustly, but will be more just than he was before he lost control of himself. But this is impossible. Therefore it is clear that acting voluntarily does not mean acting in accordance with appetition, nor acting involuntarily, acting in opposition to appetition. Also it is clear from the following considerations that voluntary action does not mean acting in accordance with purposive choice. It was proved that acting in accordance with one's wish is not acting involuntarily, 1224a. But rather, everything that one wishes is also voluntary. It has only been proved that it is possible to do a thing voluntarily without wishing. But many things that we wish we do suddenly, whereas nobody makes a purposive choice suddenly. But if, as we said, the voluntary must necessarily be one of three things, what is in conformity with appetition, or with purposive choice, or with thought, and if it is not the two former, it remains that voluntariness consists in acting with some kind of thought. Moreover, let us put a conclusion to our delimitation of the voluntary and involuntary by carrying the thought argument a little further. Acting under compulsion and not under compulsion seem to be terms akin to the ones mentioned. For we say that everything forced is involuntary, and everything involuntary is forced. So we must first consider the exact meaning of forced, and how what is forced is related to the voluntary and involuntary. It seems, then, that in the sphere of conduct, forced or necessary, and force or necessity, are the opposite of voluntary and of persuasion. And we employ the terms force and necessity in a general sense, even in the case of inanimate objects. We say that a stone travels upwards and fire downwards by force and under necessity, whereas when they travel according to their natural and intrinsic impulse, we say that they do not move under force, although nevertheless they are not spoken of as moving voluntarily. The state opposite to forced motion has no name, but when they travel contrary to their natural impulse, we say that they move by force. Similarly, also in the case of living things and of animals, we see many being acted on by force, and also acting under force when something moves them from the outside, contrary to the impulse within the thing itself. In inanimate things, the moving principle is simple, but in living things it is multiple, for appetition and rational principle are not always in harmony. Hence, whereas in the case of the other animals the factor of force is simple, as it is in the case of inanimate objects, for animals do not possess rational principle and appetition in opposition to it, but live by their appetition, in man both forms of force are present. That is, at a certain age, the age to which we attribute action in the proper sense. For we do not speak of a child as acting any more than a wild animal, but only a person who has attained to acting by rational calculation. So what is forced always seems to be painful, and no one acting under force acts gladly. Consequently, there is a great deal of dispute about the self-controlled man and the uncontrolled, for each of them acts under a conflict of impulses within him, so that the self-controlled man, they say, acts under force in dragging himself away from the pleasures that he covets, for he feels pain in dragging himself away against the resistance of appetition, while the uncontrolled man acts under force in going contrary to his rational faculty. But he seems to feel less pain because desire is for what is pleasant, and he follows his desire, so that the uncontrolled man rather acts voluntarily and not under force, because not painfully. On the other hand, persuasion is thought to be the opposite of force and necessity, and the self-controlled man is led towards things that he has been persuaded to pursue, and proceeds not under force, but voluntarily. 1224b. Whereas desire leads a man on without employing persuasion, since it possesses no element of rational principle. It has, then, been stated that these men only seem to act under force and involuntarily, and we have shown the reason. It is because their action has a certain resemblance to forced action, just as we speak of forced action even in the case of inanimate objects too. Yet, nevertheless, if one added there also the addition made in our definition, the statement is refuted. For we speak of a thing as being forced to act when something external moves it or brings it to rest, acting against the impulse within the thing itself. When there is no external motive, we do not say that it acts under force. And in the uncontrolled man and the self-controlled, it is the impulse present in the man himself that drives him, for he has both impulses, so that as far as these considerations go, neither of them would be acting under force, but voluntarily. Nor yet are they acting of necessity, for by necessity we mean an external principle that either checks or moves a man in opposition to his impulse, as if A were to take hold of B's hand, and with it strike C, B's will and desire both resisting. Whereas when the source of action is from within, we do not speak of the act as done under force. Again, both pleasure and pain are present in both cases. For a man exercising self-control both feels pain when he finally acts in opposition to his desire and enjoys the pleasure of hoping that he will be benefited later on, or is even being benefited already by being in good health. And the uncontrolled man enjoys getting what he desires owing to his lack of self-control, but feels prospective pain because he thinks he is doing a bad thing. Hence it is reasonable to say that each does what he does under compulsion, and that each is at one point acting involuntarily from motives both of appetition and of rational calculation. For calculation and appetition are things quite separate, and each is pushed aside by the other. Hence men transfer this to the spirit as a whole, because they see something of this sort in the experiences of the spirit. Now it is admissible to say this in the case of the parts, but the spirit as a whole, both in the uncontrolled and in the self-controlled man, acts voluntarily, and in neither case does the man act under compulsion, but one of the parts in them so acts. For we possess by nature both parts, since rational principle is a natural property, because it will be present in us if our growth is allowed and not stunted. And also desire is natural, because it accompanies and is present in us from birth. And these are pretty nearly the two things by which we define the natural. It is what accompanies everybody as soon as he is born, or else what comes to us if development is allowed to go on regularly, for example, grey hair, old age, etc. Therefore, each of the two persons in a way acts not in accordance with nature, but absolutely each does act according to nature, though not according to the same nature. The difficulties then raised about the uncontrolled and the self-controlled man are these. Do both or does one of them act under compulsion, so that they either act not voluntarily or else voluntarily and under compulsion at the same time? And if what is done under compulsion is involuntary, act voluntarily and involuntarily at the same time. And it is fairly clear from what has been said how these difficulties are to be met. 1225a. But there is another way in which people are said to act under compulsion and of necessity without disagreement between rational principle and appetition, when they do something that they consider actually painful and bad, but they are faced by flogging or imprisonment or execution if they do not do it. For in these cases, they say they are acting under necessity. Possibly, however, this is not the case. But they all do the actual deeds willingly, since it is open to them not to do them, but to endure the penalty threatened. Moreover, perhaps someone might say that in some cases these actions are done of necessity and in others not. For in cases where the presence or absence of such circumstances depends on the agent himself, even the actions that he does without wishing to do them he does willingly and not under compulsion. But where in such cases the circumstances do not rest with himself, he acts under compulsion in a sense, though not indeed under compulsion absolutely, because he does not definitely choose the actual thing that he does, but the object for which he does it, since even in the objects of action there is a certain difference. For if someone were to kill a man to prevent his catching him by groping for him, it would be ridiculous for him to say that he had done it under compulsion and of necessity. There must be some greater and more painful evil that he will suffer if he does not do it. It is when a man does something evil for the sake of something good, or for deliverance from another evil, that he will be acting under necessity and by compulsion, or at all events, not by nature. And then he will really be acting unwillingly, for these actions do not rest with himself. On this account, many reckon even love as involuntary, and some forms of anger and natural impulses, because their power is even beyond nature. And we pardon them as naturally capable of constraining nature. And it would be thought that a man is acting more under compulsion and involuntarily when his object is to avoid violent pain than when it is to avoid mild pain, and in general, more when his object is the avoidance of pain than when it is to gain enjoyment. For what rests with himself, and it wholly turns on this, means what his nature is able to bear. What his nature is not able to bear, and what is not a matter of his own natural appetition or calculation, does not rest with himself. On this account also in the case of persons who are inspired and utter prophecies. Although they perform an act of thought, nevertheless, we do not say that saying what they said and doing what they did rested with themselves. Nor yet do we say that what men do because of desire rests with themselves, so that some thoughts and emotions, or the actions that are guided by such thoughts and calculations, do not rest with ourselves. But it is, as Philolaus said, some arguments are too strong for us. Hence, if it was necessary to consider the voluntary and the involuntary with reference also to acting under compulsion, let this be our decision of the matter. For those who cause most hindrance, the voluntary, as acting under compulsion, but voluntarily. Now that this is concluded, and as the voluntary has been found not to be defined by appetition nor yet by purposive choice, it therefore remains to define it as that which is in accordance with thought. 1225b. Now the voluntary seems to be the opposite of the involuntary, and acting with knowledge of either the person acted on or the instrument or the result, for sometimes the agent knows that it is his father but does not intend to kill him but to save him, as the Pelleads did, or knows that what he is offering is a drink but offers it as a love charm or wine, when really it is hemlock, seems to be the opposite of acting without knowing the person acted on, the instrument and the nature of the act, through ignorance and not by accident. But to act through ignorance of the act, the means and the person acted on, is involuntary action. Therefore, the opposite is voluntary. It follows then that all the things that a man does not in ignorance and through his own agency, when it is in his power not to do them, are voluntary acts. And it is in this that the voluntary consists. And all the things that he does in ignorance, and through being in ignorance, he does involuntarily. But since to understand or know has two meanings, one being to have the knowledge and the other to use it, a man who has knowledge but is not using it would in one case be justly described as acting in ignorance, but in another case unjustly, namely, if his non-employment of the knowledge were due to carelessness. And similarly, one would be blamed for not having the knowledge if it were something that was easy or necessary, and his not having it is due to carelessness or pleasure or pain. These points, therefore, must be added to our definition. Let this, then, be our mode of definition about the voluntary and involuntary. Next, let us speak about purposive choice, first raising various difficulties about it. For one might doubt to which class it naturally belongs and in which class it ought to be put, and whether the voluntary and the purposely chosen are different things or the same thing. And a view specially put forward from some quarters, which on inquiry may seem correct, is that purposive choice is one of two things, either opinion or appetition, for both are seen to accompany it. Now it is evident that it is not appetition, for in that case it would be either wish or desire or passion, since nobody wants to get a thing without having experienced one of those feelings. Now even animals possess passion and desire, but they do not have purposive choice. And again, beings that possess both of these often make choices even without passion and desire, and while they are experiencing these feelings, do not make a choice but hold out. Again, desire and passion are always accompanied by pain. But we often make a choice even without pain. But moreover, purposive choice is not the same as wish either, for men wish for some things that they know to be impossible, for instance, to be king of all mankind and to be immortal. But nobody purposively chooses a thing knowing it to be impossible, nor in general a thing that, though possible, he does not think in his own power to do or not to do. So that this much is clear. A thing purposively chosen must necessarily be something that rests with oneself. 1226a. And similarly, it is manifest that purposive choice is not opinion either, nor something that one simply thinks. For we saw that a thing chosen is something in one's own power. But we have opinions as to many things that do not depend on us. For instance, that the diagonal of a square is incommensurable with the side. And again, choice is not true or false. Nor yet is purposive choice an opinion about practicable things within one's own power that makes us think that we ought to do or not to do something. But this characteristic is common to opinion and to wish. For no one purposively chooses any end, but the means to his end. I mean, for instance, no one chooses to be healthy, but to take a walk or sit down for the sake of being healthy. No one chooses to be well off, but to go into business or to speculate for the sake of being well off. And generally, one who makes a choice always makes it clear both what his choice is and what its object is. Object, meaning that for the sake of which he chooses something else, and choice, meaning that which he chooses for the sake of something else. Whereas clearly it is specially an end that a man wishes, and the feeling that he ought to be healthy and prosperous is an opinion. So these considerations make it clear that purposive choice is different from both opinion and wish. Forming wishes and forming opinions apply specially to one's end. Purposive choice is not of ends. It is clear, then, that purposive choice is not either wish or opinion or judgment simply. But in what does it differ from them? And how is it related to the voluntary? To answer these questions will make it clear what purposive choice is. Now, of things that can both be and not be, some are such that it is possible to deliberate about them, but about others it is not possible. Some things can either be or not be, but their coming into being does not rest with us, but in some cases is due to the operation of nature, and in others to other causes. And about these things nobody would deliberate unless in ignorance of the facts. But with some things not only their existence or non-existence is possible, but also for human beings to deliberate about them. And these are all the things that it rests with us to do or not to do. Hence we do not deliberate about affairs in India, or about how to square the circle, for affairs in India do not rest with us, whereas the objects of choice and things practicable are among things resting with us, and squaring the circle is entirely impracticable, and thus it is clear that purposive choice is not simply opinion either. But purposive choice does not deal with all the practicable things resting with us either. Hence one might also raise the question, why is it exactly that, whereas doctors deliberate about things in their field of science, scholars do not? The reason is that since error occurs in two ways, for we err either in reasoning or in perception when actually doing the thing, in medicine it is possible to err in both ways, but in grammar error only occurs in our perception and action. 1226b. To investigate which would be an endless undertaking. Since then purposive choice is not either opinion nor wish separately, nor yet both, for no one makes a deliberate choice suddenly, but men do suddenly think they ought to act and wish to act, therefore it arises as from both, for both of them are present with a person choosing. But how purposive choice arises out of opinion and wish must be considered, and indeed in a manner the actual term choice makes this clear. Choice is taking, but not taking simply. It is taking one thing in preference to another. But this cannot be done without consideration and deliberation, hence purposive choice arises out of deliberative opinion. Now nobody deliberates about his end. This everybody has fixed. But men deliberate about the means leading to their end. Does this contribute to it, or does this? Or when a means has been decided on, how will that be procured? And this deliberation as to means we all pursue until we have carried the starting point in the process of producing the end back to ourselves. If, then, nobody chooses without first preparing and deliberating as to the comparative merits of the alternatives, and a man deliberates as to those among the means to the end capable of existing or not existing that are within our power, it is clear that purposive choice is deliberate appetition of things within one's power. For we deliberate about everything that we choose, although, of course, we do not choose everything that we deliberate about. I call appetition deliberative when its origin or cause is deliberation, and when a man desires because of having deliberated. Therefore, the faculty of purposive choice is not present in the other animals, nor in man at every age, nor in every condition. For no more is the act of deliberation, nor yet the concept of cause. It is quite possible that many men may possess the faculty of forming an opinion whether to do or not to do a thing without also having the power of forming this opinion by process of reasoning. For the deliberative faculty is the spirit's power of contemplating a kind of cause. For one sort of cause is the final cause, as although cause means anything because of which a thing comes about, it is the object of a thing's existence or production that we specially designate as its cause. For instance, if a man walks in order to fetch things, fetching things is the cause of his walking. Consequently, people who have no fixed aim are not given to deliberation. Hence, inasmuch as if a man of his own accord and not through ignorance does or refrains from doing something resting with himself either to do or not to do, he acts or refrains from acting voluntarily. But yet we do many such things without deliberation or previous thought. It necessarily follows that, although all that has been purposively chosen is voluntary, voluntary is not the same as chosen. And although all things done by purposive choice are voluntary, not all things voluntary are done by purposive choice. And at the same time it is clear from these considerations that the classification of offences made by legislators as in voluntary and premeditated is a good one, 1227a, for even if it is not precisely accurate, yet at all events it approximates to the truth in a way. But we will speak about this in our examination of justice. As to purposive choice, it is clear that it is not absolutely identical with wish nor with opinion, but is opinion plus appetition when these follow as a conclusion from deliberation. But since one who deliberates always deliberates for the sake of some object, and a man deliberating always has some aim in view with reference to which he considers what is expedient, nobody deliberates about his end, but this is a starting point or assumption, like the postulates in the theoretic sciences. We have spoken about this briefly at the beginning of this discourse, and in detail in analytics. Whereas with all men, deliberation, whether technical or untechnical, is about the means that lead to their end, e.g. when they deliberate about whether to go to war or not to go to war, with a given person. And the question of means will depend rather on a prior question, that is, the question of object, for instance wealth or pleasure, or something else of that kind which happens to be our object. For one who deliberates if he has considered from the standpoint of the end either what tends to enable him to bring the end to himself or how he can himself go to the end. And by nature, the end is always a good and a thing about which men deliberate step by step. For example, a doctor may deliberate whether he shall give a drug, and a general where he shall pitch his camp, when their end is the good that is the absolute best. But in contravention of nature and by perversion, not the good but the apparent good is the end. The reason is that there are some things that cannot be employed for something other than their natural objects, for instance, sight. It is not possible to see a thing that is not visible, or to hear a thing that is not audible. But a science does enable us to do a thing that is not the object of the science. For health and disease are not the objects of the same science in the same way. Health is its object in accordance with nature, and disease in contravention of nature. And similarly, by nature good is the object of wish, but evil is also its object in contravention of nature. By nature, one wishes good. Against nature, and by perversion, one even wishes evil. But moreover, with everything, its corruption and perversion are not in any chance direction, but leads to the contrary and intermediate states. For it is not possible to go outside these, since even error does not lead to any chance thing. But in the case of things that have contraries, to the contraries, and to those contraries that are contrary according to their science. It therefore necessarily follows that both error and purposive choice take place from the middle point to the contraries, the contraries of the middle being the more and the less. And the cause is pleasure and pain, for things are so constituted that the pleasant appears to the spirit good, and the more pleasant better, the painful bad, and the more painful worse. 1227b. So from these things also, it is clear that goodness and badness have to do with pleasures and pains, for they occur in connection with the objects of purposive choice, and this has to do with good and bad, and what appears to be good and bad, and pleasure and pain are by nature things of that kind. It therefore follows that since moral goodness is itself a middle state and is entirely concerned with pleasures and pain, and badness consists in excess and defect, and is concerned with the same things as goodness, moral goodness, or virtue, is a state of purposively choosing the mean in relation to ourselves in all those pleasant and painful things in regard to which, according as a person feels pleasure or pain, he is described as having some particular moral quality. For a person is not said to have a particular moral character merely for being fond of sweets or savouries. These things having been settled, let us say, whether goodness makes the purposive choice correct and the end right, in the sense of making the agent choose for the sake of the proper end, or whether, as some hold, it makes the rational principle right. But what does this is self-control. For that saves the rational principle from being corrupted. And goodness and self-control are different. But we must speak about this later. Since all who do hold that goodness makes the rational principle right, think so on the ground that that is the nature of self-control, and self-control is a praiseworthy thing. Having raised this preliminary question, let us continue. It is possible to have one's aim right, but to be entirely wrong in one's means to the end aimed at. And it is possible for the aim to have been wrongly chosen, but the means conducing to it to be right, and for neither to be right. But does goodness decide the aim or the means to it? Well, our position is that it decides the aim, because this is not a matter of logical inference or rational principle, but in fact this must be assumed as a starting point. For a doctor does not consider whether his patient ought to be healthy or not, but whether he ought to take walking exercise or not. and the gymnastic trainer does not consider whether his pupil ought to be in good condition or not, but whether he ought to go in for wrestling or not. And similarly, no other science either deliberates about its end. For as in the theoretic sciences the assumptions are first principles, so in the productive sciences the end is a starting point and assumption. Since it is required that so-and-so is to be in good health, if that is to be secured, it is necessary for such and such a thing to be provided. Just as in mathematics, if the angles of a triangle are together equal to two right angles, such and such a consequence necessarily follows. Therefore, the end is the starting point of the process of thought, but the conclusion of the process of thought is the starting point of action. If then, of all rightness, either rational principle or goodness is the cause. If rational principle is not the cause of the rightness of the end, then the end, though not the means to the end, will be right owing to goodness. But the end is the object for which one acts. For every purposive choice is a choice of something and for some object. The end is therefore the object for which the thing chosen is the mean, of which end goodness is the cause by its act of choice, though the choice is not of the end, but of the means adopted for the sake of the end. Therefore, though it belongs to another faculty to hit on the things that must be done for the sake of the end, 1228a, goodness is the cause of the end aimed at by choice being right. And owing to this, it is by a man's purposive choice that we judge his character. That is, not by what he does, but what he does it for. Similarly, also badness causes purposive choice to be made from the opposite motives. If therefore, when a man has it in his power to do what is honourable and refrain from doing what is base, he does the opposite, it is clear that this man is not virtuous. Hence it necessarily follows that both badness and goodness are voluntary, for there is no necessity to do wicked things. For this reason, badness is a blameworthy thing and goodness praiseworthy. For involuntary baseness and evil are not blamed nor involuntary good things praised, but voluntary ones are. Moreover, we praise and blame all men with regard to their purpose rather than with regard to their actions, although activity is a more desirable thing than goodness. Because men may do bad acts under compulsion, but no one is compelled to choose to do them. Moreover, because it is not easy to see the quality of a man's purpose, we are forced to judge his character from his actions. Therefore, activity is more desirable, but purpose more praiseworthy. And this not only follows from our assumptions, but also is admitted by reason of observed facts. Book 3. It has then been stated in general terms that there are middle states in the virtues, and that these are purposive, and also that the opposite dispositions are vices and what these are. But let us take them separately and discuss them seriatim. And first, let us speak about courage. Now almost everybody holds that the brave man is concerned with fears and that courage is one of the virtues. And in our schedule previously, we distinguished daring and fear as contraries, for they are indeed in a manner opposed to one another. It is clear, therefore, that the persons named after these states of character will also be similarly opposed to each other. That is, the coward, for that is the term that denotes being more afraid than is proper and less daring than is proper, and the daring man, for that denotes the characteristic of being less afraid than is proper and more daring than is proper. And from this the name is derived, as the word daring is cognate with the word dare. So that since courage is the best state of character in relation to feelings of fear and daring, and the proper character is neither that of the daring, for they fall short in one respect and exceed in another, nor that of the cowardly, for they also do the same, only not as regards the same things, but inversely. 1228b. They fall short in daring, and exceed,